2-1. He gets one in the air to deep left field. Back toward the corner goes Thomas. Right back near the wall. It's out of here! Grand slam, Pete Alonso! A towering grand slam for Pete for his first home run. And the Mets have a 4-0 lead.
Hi, this is Emily Nyman, and you're listening to Breaking Balls. Welcome to episode 100 of Breaking Balls. I'm your host, Emily Nyman. I'm, of course, joined by my co-host, John Snyder. You can find us on Twitter, at BreakBallsPod. Or, if you're feeling brassy, give the Breaking Balls hotline a call. 631-820-7377. 99 episodes in the books. Opening weekend in the books. I mean, it doesn't get much better than this, does it, John?
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't, Emily. It doesn't get any better than this. And I just can't imagine a scenario in which it gets any better than this. Episode 100, the double bagel. We did it. We're going to go out on top, right? Like, this is it?
Yeah, this is, no, now we're going to like Benjamin Button this show. And we're going to now start counting backwards.
Episode 99. That's like when we were kids, your mom, whenever we asked your mom how old she was like, well, when I turned 40, I started counting backwards. So I'm in my early 30s.
It is really fucking crazy because like 100 episodes is a lot, first of all. I've never done anything this consistently that like I either didn't have to do, like going to work or to school, or right. Like was the love of my life in that like playing sports, besides those things.
I was gonna say, what else have I done 100 times?
And it's crazy because it doesn't feel like it's been 100 episodes, and that's because, no. And not to sound cheesy, but I really do mean this, that this has been one of the best experiences of my life. I have so much fun recording this with you and recording it with DJ Bingington. You guys are my two best friends and it's just been unbelievable. This past weekend, actually on my birthday, a good friend of my sister Claire's, she teaches a class for high school seniors in Nebraska and they're doing like a podcast unit. So they asked to interview me. And one of the questions was, you know, if you could go back and change anything, what would you change and what would you do differently? And like, I felt like a herb because I literally sat there and thought about it. And I even had like a day to think about it because she sent me the questions early. There was nothing. There was literally nothing that I would go back and change. And that like makes me feel really, really blessed.
Well, I'll tell you what I would change, Emily. I would change doing this celebration on episode 100 because we all know that Breaking Balls really started episode 5. So 105 is going to be the big one for me. I'm humoring you this week with all these festivities. It's very cool. Congratulations.
Thank
but
you.
I think we all know where this bread is buttered.
We're going to have to do the same sentimental recap on episode 105 for your 100th episode.
I had to break that up with some humor, but of course, on a serious note, all of that and more is reciprocated. This has been such a blast working with you and DJ Bingington. I don't want to sound like a broken record and say everything you said, but I agree. It's amazing. I can't wait for the next 100.
What wasn't so amazing, however, Gerrit Cole, the Yankees ace, the $324 million man, did not have the best opening day. I mean, it didn't start well. That known scoundrel, Billy Crystal, had the nerve to make his first pitch, the ceremonial first pitch, last longer than was anticipated. The game started 4 minutes late, totally unacceptable, and that apparently is what threw Cole off his game. That's literally what he said.
What a dork. That is the dorkiest shit ever. I'm sorry. Like, I know that as a pitcher, you know, you're going to be quirky and you like adhering to a schedule, but 4 minutes, like in any given inning, you don't know how long you're going to be sitting, but like, you know, God forbid we don't start on time. And so then homeboy proceeded to give up 3 runs and get booed in the first inning of his first game of the season. Baseball's back. What can I say?
I just love the idea of him. He threw 4 straight balls to Kike Hernandez. And then on the second pitch of Rafael Devers at bat, who was next, he fucking hit a ball to the moon, 2-run home run. He blamed that on Billy Crystal, basically. Right. That's what this boils down to.
Which is even funnier because, like, Billy Crystal is, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the more prominent celebrity Yankee fans. Mm-hmm. So the idea that, like, after all these decades of Yankee fandom and going all the games and being on the Jumbotron, he's actually, like, a double agent. for the Red Sox. And, you know, he's just like, this whole time, it's been leading up to having Cole blow his opening day start in 2022.
He kind of settled down after that, though. I mean, he only pitched 4 innings, 68 pitches, not very economical there. Most pitchers are on some kind of pitch count because of the truncated spring training, beginning of the season, yada, yada. Like, Cole usually pitches like 15 to 20 innings during spring training. He only pitched 5. And I'm not blaming his start on that per se, but I'm waiting until like the next few starts to really get, you know, worried or whatever. I'm always in a zone of not being worried about Gerrit Cole. You know what I mean? Like, I won't fucking adhere to that.
No, I don't know what you mean, because I've been led to believe that if not for Billy Crystal shenanigans, we were in store for a complete game shutout.
Yeah, so basically I just have to keep my eye on that fucking scoundrel, Billy Crystal.
I love that known scoundrel.
My favorite player of all time, Josh Donaldson, he delivered me a W on my birthday, their opening day. I couldn't believe it. I mean, like I had mentioned last week, historically, they do not do very well on my birthday. So now we are working towards at least 500 win-loss percentage on April 8th, because now they're 13-16.
I mean, hey, little birthday present there, a little walk-off action. It's more of a present than I remembered to get you, so I hope that you enjoyed that.
I did, and you know what? It serves me right that it was Donaldson, because it's like, okay, I've been kind of like, yeah, I like Donaldson now, I guess he's on the team. And it was just in my face on my birthday. Like, now I have to fucking love this guy because he did that.
It was never not going to be Donaldson after all that. And I should add, it's even funnier now that we have 2 years of these in the books. If you want to go back and hear Emily's true feelings on Josh Donaldson, it's recorded. It's preserved for posterity. So go for it.
Or just go to Twitter and search my handle and Donaldson. And you will see quite a string of tweets from last year and beyond where I don't really have the kindest things to say. But my account was hacked during all those times. What can I know the internet. You guys know how it is.
It's true. Except for the funny tweets that went viral. Those were Emily. But most of that shit was, yeah, she got hacked.
The Yankees finished the weekend with 2 wins and 1 loss to the Red Sox. The name of the game is win series. I'm happy that they won the series. I'm happy that they came out and won the first 2 games. Losing the 3rd game or the last game of any series is always like air being let out of the balloon. It feels like you lost the series even though you didn't.
It does. And you're always incoming with the inevitable perspective check where it's like, well, okay, if we win 2 out of every 3 games for the rest of the season, that's a great record and we're making the playoffs and all that stuff.
Monty pitched game 2. He did okay. He got drilled in the side of the knee. He was able to fight through it and pitch not the rest of the game. He pitched maybe like 3 or 4 innings, but the MRI came back negative. X-rays came back negative, so he should be okay. Sevy, we got to see him as a starter. He hasn't started a game, I think, since like 2019 playoffs, maybe, or maybe 2018. He did pretty well. I mean, he gave up a home run, but he looked pretty sharp. He had pretty good command of his pitches, and I'm really fucking excited to see what he does this year. I'm hoping that he's able to stay healthy, and I know that is like the most obvious statement ever, but it really is the name of the game, and I think that he can be a real game changer for the Yankees this year. So it was really encouraging to see him face a pretty potent lineup. I mean, the Red Sox have some issues, but their lineup is pretty fucking stacked.
I mean, the Red Sox, despite having a stacked lineup, have not looked particularly good so far. Ah. So it was funny because, like, when you first started saying that, I was like, no, they don't. I was like, wait, no, they do. They just have played like shit through the beginning of the season.
The bullpen, of course, was elite. That's what carried the Yankees last year. It's going to carry them this year. People are already getting frustrated by, like, 1 pitcher per inning. Like, why do they keep taking these guys out? Like, leave them in. And I know that they historically do that too, but they didn't pitch much in spring training. They can't have these guys out there throwing 100 miles an hour in 40-degree weather when they've thrown like fucking 3 innings during spring training. Like, come on.
Unless you're a psychopath like Max Scherzer and it's like, I'm going to throw 6 innings in my 2nd spring start, you know, just to get warmed up a little bit.
I mean, I have been liking the Mets starting pitching management because he wasn't the only Mets starter that went 6 innings. I mean, that's a quality start, literally.
No, yeah. He and Bassett both went 6, and the Mets starting pitching has been the highlight of the season thus far. We're actually recording this late enough on Tuesday that we got the results for the Mets game. They won against the Phillies. No, but now so we have 6 games worth of info for the starting pitchers, and these are some pretty good numbers. There's a total of 30 innings pitched, 14 hits given up, 4 earned runs, and 34 strikeouts. over six games and 30 innings, that's not too shabby.
Not bad.
Now, I can't necessarily say the same for the bullpen, but we'll get there in a second. DeGrom is hurt, so McGill filled in for opening day. He was outstanding and did the same thing tonight. He has yet to give up an earned run over 11 innings. Most impressive to me so far was Chris Bassitt. I love this guy. He's not an overpowering pitcher, but the dude pitches. You know what I mean? Curveballs, off-speed stuff, mixing it up. Six innings, three hits, no runs, eight strikeouts. He looked fantastic. You know, funnily enough, the pitcher on the Mets staff that's given up the most run, the starter, I should say, who's given up the most runs so far is Scherzer. He gave
bum.
Up six.
That's all I had to say. He's a bum.
Oh, I didn't hear bum. I thought you said like you had something intelligent to add, but I should have known better. but yeah, Scherzer, you know, he gave up those three runs before he settled down. And that being, well, maybe not the worst point because Walker only lasted two innings. But, I mean, he gave up no runs and he struck out four guys. So hopefully he's not too bad. They actually sent him down to the minors. He apparently had some shoulder issues. Walker, we're talking about now. He needs to build up his pitch count a little bit before he rejoins the rotation.
So yeah, they said he has a bursitis on his shoulder.
Now, I didn't see if they're trying to get him back in time for his next start or if he's going to miss the next one and who would fill in. Supposedly, David Peterson, I would think, would be next up in line. He took over for him after he had to come out after two innings. So that's my best guess. But yeah, so the starters have looked good. The Mets overall are off to a pretty good start. We're 4-2 on the year. We kind of had the same thing that the Yankees went through insofar as we started with a series against the Nationals of four games, won the first three. We're looking for our first ever four-game series sweep to start off a season, and we lost. And the doom and gloom came out immediately from the fan base, just like, oh, this bullpen and these starters and this offense. It's like, guys, we're 3-1. We had a bad inning. Like, this shit's going to happen.
It was like very much like in Futurama when he's like,
you raised my hopes and dashed them quite expertly, sir. Bravo!
You've raised my hopes and dashed them quite expertly, sir.
Quite expertly, sir. But it's like everybody forgets how baseball works over the course of the offseason. It's like, yo, the Mets are going to lose 70-some-odd games if everything goes great. You gotta have, you know what I'm saying? Like, if it goes well, this is going to happen 69 more times. Like, take a deep breath, chill. 4-2 is a good start to a season. We're looking pretty good, all things considered.
And there were some fucking fireworks during that series. I mean, the Mets had five hit-by-pitches in 20 innings, and three of them almost broke their teeth. Lindor, Alonso, and McCann all almost ate a fucking pitch to the face. Like, what the fuck? Get control of your shit. Or don't throw inside.
Right, and that's the thing. It's like, I mean, A, if you can't do that, you shouldn't be pitching at this level anyway. But even if you're struggling in that moment, you can't go up and in. If you're going to risk hitting somebody, like, you lose the right to mess with that area of the strike zone. If you can't do it like a professional, do it safely, not put the batter in mortal peril. You know what I mean? And that was especially scary. Lindor was even saying that he was actually thinking about taking the C-flap off of his helmet before that game. Thank God he didn't. He only got out of that with a cracked tooth, but that hit him right in the kisser. That was scary. He went down. That was the final straw. The bench is cleared. One thing you got to love, I mean, A, Buck Showalter in general, you got to love. Him as manager has just been fantastic thus far. Buck was the first one out of the dugout, leading the charge, jawing at the Nats like they needed to. And that was just great to see. Like, there's no hesitancy, no, like, looking to the manager for the leader, like, what do we do? Manager was gone by the time they looked over to see what he was doing. He was already out there.
And that was a sick baseball fight. I mean, they all crowded around and then just, like, kind of pushed each other. Like,
bullpen's cleared,
runs.
And then 2 minutes later, they're moseying on back out to the outfield.
It's so fucking stupid. Like, we got to get out there. And then they're just like, all right, hold me back. Hold me back.
Right. And, you know, I mean, it's not just the pitching. I mean, the starting pitching has been the highlight. But a lot of these new guys are looking pretty good. You know, in addition to Bassitt and Scherzer, Escobar is hitting. He's got, and these are all early numbers, but I love it this early in the season when the numbers are so inflated. So get a load of these. So Escobar has a 944 OPS and a 184 OPS plus.
Only I'm sure he'll maintain.
Right. Only outdone by Mark Canna, who's gone 8 for 14. That leaves him with an OPS of 1.218 and an OPS plus, are you sitting down, of 269.
I mean, there's nowhere to go but up from there.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Donaldson has been pretty good, too. The new guys are really fucking making it happen this year. Well, in the first weekend, anyway.
Right, yeah, I'll tell you what. This year has really been... and I added McNeil to that list, too, because he looks like the old McNeil. So I'm going to say that he's a new player, too, because he was trying to kill everything last year and it was not working out for him. Now, I'll tell you, Emily, Nationals pitchers hitting five Mets in a series is not a good look. What was a good look was this Apple broadcast. That picture, we'll get into the commentary in a second. That picture was crystal clear. It made every other baseball broadcast I've ever seen look like dog crap. It really did.
Literally. It was unfucking believable how clear it was. And the graphics were really clean too. Like, you know, when they give the hitter's name and stats or whatever, that I really liked how that looked. It was classic Apple as far as like,
it looked just like an iPhone bones. Notification.
Literally, it did. No wonder I liked it. But what was kind of weird was in the bottom right-hand corner, they had like different changing stats, like probabilities or whatever. And granted, I didn't pay that close attention, but where were they getting these numbers from? Like at one point, Tomas Nido was up and it said that he had a hit probability of like 53%. No chance. This guy is like, he's most likely going to get a hit. No, he is not.
Especially this early in the season. It's like, what are we basing these on? And not for nothing, like nothing ever approached like, you know, 90s or like single digits. So it's like, no matter what happens, it's like, see, the numbers hold up. Like we didn't guarantee anything. It's like, well, yeah, you sure didn't. I could have done without those. Those were a little pointless.
The commentary left a lot to be desired. On one hand, I appreciated the like relaxed commentary they were trying to go for. It was trying to be a bit more conversational, but they got commentators who don't know the game at all.
Right. There's so, a like, line. There's a line.
This sport, if it were basketball, and this is obviously a huge guess on my part, but just because of time alone, like if it were only an hour and a half long or whatever, then maybe it wouldn't have been as bad. But when you're watching a 3-hour game, like to have the commentary be nothing that's really related to what's happening on the field is frustrating. And I'm someone who kind of tunes out commentary because I think most of it is annoying on any network. But this one in particular was like, what the fuck are they talking about?
And I was going to say, you and I in particular, I would consider ourselves to be experts in tangential conversations, you know?
I would say so.
Keeping it relevant, but keeping it
Episode
interesting
100.
And multivariate. Yeah, I was going to say, this is an alternate title for the podcast, believe it or not. No, it wasn't. But... But yeah, it's like, listen, like you can go off on tangents, but like know how you're going to circle back, you know how it's connected, you know, how you can then bring it back to baseball, go off on another tangent. This was like, it was so beyond tangential. I don't even remember some of the stuff they were talking about, but it had nothing to do with baseball. Like they would just get off and be like, so nice weather we're having. How much you have for dinner tonight? You? No? Seen any good movies lately? Like, come on, there's a game going on.
And the analysts, I felt bad for them just because, like, they're not broadcasters, they're analysts. So they didn't really know, they could not segue well. So especially when the conversation is not really related to the game, they would want to, like, talk about something that's happening, but they didn't know how to, like, get it there. So they would just then, like, say something about the game, and then no one in the booth would comment, or they'd be like, oh, yeah, that reminds me of, like, the time my aunt, or, and then right. Go off on some other fucking tangent, and it's like, okay, I guess we're just doing this.
I mean, it's important to note that all the most successful broadcast teams have a formula that works. You have your play-by-play guy that leads the charge, and that's important, not just in somebody that's good at calling plays, but when it does start veering off topic, or, like, you know, we're getting a little too far out there, you're the guy that brings it back. You know, you have your color analysts to get goofy and stuff like that. You know, your Muds, your Keith Hernandez's, yada, yada, yada. But yeah, you need a Don Ursillo, a Gary Cohen, one of those guys just to bring it back. And they didn't have that anchor. And I think that's why they struggled.
And that's not to say that I won't watch these broadcasts in the future. Obviously, I'm going to. I watch as many games as I can. But it was their first time doing this. And a lot of them are like professional personalities. It's not like they pulled people off the street. So
right.
I have faith that, you know, someone like Katie Nolan or whatever is going to be able to get in a groove and find out how they are going to perform in this space. They were just all kind of thrown into it. I don't think they did any other games, like any practice games. It's just like, all right, good luck. So I'm hopeful for the future because it's not like they had a bunch of scrubs. They just had people who didn't really know how to do this and weren't really given much instruction, it seemed.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, just our luck as Mets fans that we were the guinea pigs for this whole operation. Because not for nothing, like, this was the game with the benches clearing. Well, brawl is a strong word, but this is the game where the benches cleared. And I wasn't able to watch that one because of work. So I go back to watch it. I'm like, oh, I'm interested to see, forgetting what the broadcast was. I'm like, oh, what's Gary going to have to say about this? And I go back and it's like they seemed somewhat aware that it was going on, but they didn't really have anything much to add about it. I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. Like, well, yeah, okay. But like, can you add a little bit more context, please?
ESPN Sunday Night Baseball also had a few firsts. This was a pretty exciting weekend. They had their regular broadcast was, in the past, A-Rod, Vasgersian, and Jessica Mendoza. Now it's a totally different team. It's Carl Ravitch as the play-by-play guy, Eduardo Perez, and David Cohn as the analyst. That broadcast was great. Ravitch is whatever. I'm not that crazy about Perez, but David Cohn is fucking...
Cone's awesome.
Amazing. He's amazing. We have enjoyed him so much on the Yes Network, and I'm really glad that the national audience is now getting a chance to hear how good he is.
Now, maybe I just haven't, because granted, I haven't watched all the Yankees games so far. Has Maben done a game yet?
No, he hasn't done a game yet.
Come on, what are they doing? He was awesome in the spring.
Now, that wasn't the only broadcast of the Sunday night game. They had the first go of the K-Rod cast, the Michael Kay and Alex Rodriguez cast that's supposed to be like the Manning cast. And listen, it was pretty good. I'm not going to, like, for what it was, if you go into that cast expecting it to be like the best thing you've ever seen, then no, it is not even close to that. But right. It was way better than A-Rod, Vasgersian, and Mendoza doing the game because it was much more relaxed. They had Big Poppy call in. They had Roger Clemens call in, a few other guys call in, and it was entertaining. And I think that something like that, and maybe it may not end up being Kay and A-Rod in the future, but I do think that there is a future for this sort of broadcast in baseball, if for no other reason than how fucking long and how dry some of the games can be, that it filled in some time.
And you know what's funny is I admittedly didn't catch the K-Rod cast this week because I have very little incentive to except for this podcast. So I guess I will in the future. But anyway, point being, it's funny because the other day, just to have a game on in the background, the Angels were playing. It was a day game. And I had the Angels on and I had their home broadcast going. I must be like traumatized or it's like Stockholm Syndrome because I hear Matt Vasgersian and I still feel like I'm watching ESPN or playing MLB The Show. Like he is that ubiquitous at this point.
He called a F9 by Otani like he had hit it 600 feet. It was caught like 25 feet in front of the wall. And I was like, this guy has been so horny to make this home run call for yes. The months of the offseason that he just, any fly ball, he was making that call.
And speaking of home runs, just before we wrap up the New York baseball section of the podcast, we can't get out of this, or rather, I will not let us get out of this, Emily, without talking about our opening just briefly. Pete Alonso, the polar bear, finally hit his first career grand slam to put Peter. The Mets up. Oh, it was Peter. We do just a little context. So if you watch Pete Alonso's at-bats, he has two moves that he does, right? He does like the check swing. He does a lot of those. And then he'll do this thing where he closes his eyes. He looks up to the heavens and he just like puts his bat up against his head. And Emily and I realized that in his head, he could only be saying one thing, which is his first name over and over in whispered, desperate tones. So every time he's up to bat and he does that, if we're watching, you just hear, Peter, come on, Peter. But I just wanted to bring this up because if you haven't seen it, you absolutely have to. If for nothing else, then the bat flip this dude did.
Yeah, it was elite. It was an elite bat flip.
It was an elite bat flip. That's already the first week of the season in the running for bat flap of the season. He transferred to the heavy part of the bat, and it was like putting on the Ritz from Young Frankenstein. He gave him the old razzle dazzle. He did the couple little turns as he walked away. It was awesome.
The wind was blowing in from left field that night because that was a fucking moonshot. It was a 39-degree launch angle.
It was a towering, yeah.
Perfect way to describe it. A towering home run.
I still like Gary Cohen, but yeah, keep going.
Well, all of a sudden, so when he hit it, it seemed like a no-doubter, but then it took so long to get over the wall that if there was a stronger breeze, I was like, oh my God, please no, don't get fucking blown back. And then it like landed in like the first few rows of the left field seating, and it was like, thank fucking God, because he'd already flipped the bat at that point.
You know, right? Well, that's what was funny. Was like in the post game when they asked him about the bad flip, he was like, "Ah, you know, I knew it, and I had to let them know." But the subtext being like, "But it was a little nerve wracking there." By the time I was rounding second,
I'm actually kind of surprised that that was his first Grand Slam. But it makes sense because 2020 wasn't even close to a full season,
right?
So, and that was what his like second season in the league, wasn't 2019 his rookie year?
Yes.
So I feel like he's been around forever, but he hasn't been. And I literally, when I heard that it was his first one, I went, aww. Like, well, I don't know why. The Astros and Angels faced off this weekend. They were actually the other Apple TV or Apple Plus broadcasts. And it was really cool, actually. The day that Severino started, he wasn't the only guy that was coming back from, like, major injury on that same day. Verlander and Syndergaard both pitched on that day. And they pitched against each other. Like, I fucking love that that matched up that way. And they both pitched really well. It was a fucking pitcher's duel. Verlander went 5 innings, only gave up 3 hits, 1 home run, classic Verlander, and had 7 strikeouts. And Thor ended up getting the win for the Angels, went 5.1 innings, 2 hits, no earned runs, and 1 strikeout, which I feel is to be expected because the Astros lineup is insane. So I couldn't believe that he was able to come back and silence that lineup like that.
Well, you know what's interesting, too, is Noah Syndergaard typically was never a 1 strikeout per game guy, you know?
Right,
power pitcher. Shows that this is the new post-Tommy John Thor, where he's not necessarily going to be a flamethrower anymore, you know, overpowering guys. This was more of, like we talked about with Bassett, more of a pitching, you know, in italics or capitalized, whatever you want to do to it. It was more of a pitching performance, you know? He pitched his way to that win. And I'm somebody who, you know, as a Mets fan, you know, watching Thor come up, I'm rooting for him, man. I'm totally hoping all the best. Yeah, it was great to see. And especially because, like, I don't like Verlander that much. It was like, oh, he won. That's good. Cool. Good for you, Thor.
I have such, like, love-hate is not even close to the word because I do not love Justin Verlander at all. He's one of my most despised major leaguers.
Tolerate-hate.
Like, yeah, because, like, he's not a bad guy, you know? So it's like, I was happy to see him return, and I will be happy to see him pitch well against other teams that aren't the Yankees. But I was still, like, seething also, kind of, like, fuck you, Verlander.
And, you know, not to get too deep into it, I think it is important to make the distinction between, like, you know, there are some genuinely bad people in the league. You know, domestic violence and all that. So it's a difference between, like, you know, hating those guys versus, like, there's some guys, like, it's baseball. Like, by all accounts, they're good guys. They do nothing. I just dislike them.
Yeah,
and that's an important distinction, you know, that you're totally allowed to do that.
I fan hate them, not real hate them.
Exactly.
Nike City Connects are back. Another 7 teams will have their uniforms revealed this year. The first one was the Nationals, which were pretty cool. They were gray with a cream bottom. They are supposed to, like, represent the cherry blossoms in D.C.
So before we get into the good ones, I just want to, because I had to watch 4 games of the Nationals in these uniforms. I like the idea with the cherry blossoms, but it's like, A, do more pink. Like, just make it pink at that point, right? Seeing a home team play in a gray jersey, that just doesn't do it for me. You know, it's like darker gray versus the Mets' slightly lighter grays. Like, I didn't dig that. I'm not as big.
Would have been cooler if the whole thing was cream. The bottom and the top.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Make the whole thing cream, then with some pink flowers and whatever. It could have been better done. And
the WAS across the chest I didn't really like either. W-A-S, like, that's your abbreviation for, like, the newspaper.
It was W-S-H, but still, it was it was like an airport code or something, you know? It's like, it's like, watch, the Yankees, when they get to us, like, the Mets and the Yankees, it's going to be some, like, NYC, not even our colors, you know, Statue of Liberty green or some shit.
EWR for fucking Newark Airport. Like, it's a whole tri-state area.
Dude,
okay?
That would be so funny if the Yankees get that and then we get the LaGuardia code for the Mets.
The Astros were just released about, I think, like a day or two ago. And man,
awesome.
Those are fucking awesome. Sharp. The dark navy blue with a ombre piping that was like orange and red, and the space font. I don't really know how else to describe it.
I would call it the NASA font because NASA perfect. Does the thing where they don't cross their A's, and that's the kind of, it looks awesome. It looks great.
Yeah, I'm Not even low-key. High-key. I am getting a fucking Bregman jersey that has Space City across the front. Like, I just they killed it with that one. It's the best one by far, in my opinion, including last year's.
It beats all of them last year. I 100% agree. Yeah, it was great. And I even like the color fading on the socks almost makes it look like the flame tail of a rocket. Like, yeah, just sick. Everything about it was just so well executed. Well done.
The other five teams that are going to have their City Connects released this year are the Rockies, which will be on June 4th, the Royals on April 30th, so that's the next one coming up, the Angels on June 11th, the Brewers on June 24th, and the Padres on July 8th.
And it's funny because they seem to think that by spreading out their reveals, they're creating this like sense of anticipation, when really they're creating this sense of dread because everybody's waiting for like, oh God, how bad are ours going to be? I'm going to have to see my team wear this for the rest of the year.
Or they should have done the Astros on fucking July 8th because it's like, okay, these are definitely going to be the best ones. So now how are these other ones going right to follow it up?
Hey, man, maybe they got something up their sleeves. I don't know. Like, but yeah, it's going to be tough to top those Astros ones.
And speaking of being tough to top something, our dear leader, Commissioner Manfred.
Chairman Manfred.
He recently said that he really wants to extend an olive branch to the players. The lockout was ugly. He wants to try to mend his relationship with them. And his first Band-Aid over that wound is, no, not more money for the players. No, not anything that they actually wanted during the lockout. He's giving all of them one pair of noise-canceling Bose headphones. What the fuck is that? Like, of all things, like, here's headphones, guys.
Now, I love it, too, the way that they're presenting this, because it's that with a note from the commissioner, you know, trying to mend bridges. It's like, all right, if you use your head at all, Manfred is not paying for these. Bose must be a partner of MLB on some level, so they're just giving them all these headphones. I guarantee you Manfred did not write that note himself. It's his PR team putting it together. Like, it's just his name on it. And just the whole idea that it's like, hey, remember when I spent all those months trying to pay you as little as possible? Well, hey, here's a pair of headphones that you could definitely afford even at that potentially reduced pay rate. We're good now, right? It's all cool. Yeah, bygones be bygones. Water under the bridge, yeah.
It is MLB's version of like when corporations will be like, listen, we're not doing salary raises this year, but we are having employee right appreciation every Friday, pizza in the break room, and it's like, just pay us more money.
Anytime a corporation, even to customers, when a corporation's like, our gift to you, it's like, oh yeah, yeah, you really put yourself out for this one.
And of course, as to be expected, nothing for the minor leaguers. I mean, they're not in the union, but I love how he's like, fuck them. I don't have anything to appease with them. I don't care what they think of me.
They just send them like the cheap AirBuds that you get on a plane, just like in the plastic wrapping.
The free fucking Apple headphones that come in like the iPhone cases.
Knockoff AirPods.
Before we get into the voicemails, we have some breaking ball stats that we thought you guys would like to hear because...
Wait, did we mention it's the 100th episode, Emily?
One
double bagel.
There it is.
The 100th episode. So as you guys can imagine, because you listen to us talk every week for anywhere between like 38 minutes to slightly over an hour, we have recorded a
shitload.
Spoiler
for this week.
Yeah, seriously. We have recorded a shitload of audio, and by shitload, I have exact numbers for that. Now,
I was going to say, this is shitload as a technical term.
Drum roll, please. We've had a total of 82 hours, 53 minutes, and 32 seconds worth of episodes. That is 3.5 days worth of John and I talking. I mean, who doesn't want to listen to that?
I was going to say, if you're a real fan, you subject yourself to that once annually, minimum. It's only going to get longer from here, folks. Take the 3.5 days while it's only 3.5 days.
We also have the unedited time. Not down to the hours, because I didn't do the math. I did try.
The director's cut.
Yeah. Unedited audio. Now, just to bring it back, the edited audio was 4,920 minutes on average. The unedited, 5,320 minutes that, mind you guys don't have to listen to, but DJ Bingington listens to every goddamn painstaking minute of that and decides that, like, what is that? 800 minutes to be cut over the course of the last 99 episodes.
It's really like, you know, we're celebrating 100 episodes, but really it's like a DJ Bingington appreciation hour is what this really needs to be.
Especially when you hear these next few stats. Now, this is the time that DJ Bingington has spent editing this show. 52,800 minutes, which is approximately 880 hours or 36 and a half days. This man has spent an entire month of his life listening to John and I talk and making this show for you guys.
And think of that perspective for any of you who are not good at math. Not that I'm great, but I can do this in my head. The amount of time that we have edited total as released episodes, he spent 12 times as much time editing that. 12 times. That's literally like for every hour that you hear, he's basically taken 12 hours of his week to edit that and to get that down to that digestible 45 minutes, hour, whatever it is. It's a truly impressive Herculean effort, and we literally could not do any of this without him.
And those stats are really giving me some nice perspective. In the beginning, I had a very hard time not only recording, but a very hard time listening to the recording once it was done. And after he would be finished editing the episode, he'd be like, all right, you know, now you have to listen to it. And I would be like, no, I don't want to listen to it. And he was like, oh, you're going to fucking listen to this episode. And now I get it, because he has to listen to it for hours.
So yeah, you can't be put out for an hour.
And on that note, let's get right into the voicemails. Our first voicemail is from Mike B.
Hey, this is Mike B923. I just want to say, Emily, have a great happy birthday. And your podcast is great. Your podcast is great. And hope to see you guys soon at a game. Have a good one, guys.
Mike, thank you so much for calling and saying that. I did have a very happy birthday. Not only did the Yankees bring me a W, but I got to watch baseball for basically like 12 hours straight. I took the day off from work, so it was fucking excellent. And I hope to see you at a game soon, too. And also, it's worth noting that Mike called at 12:05 a.m. on my birthday, and I really fucking appreciate that sort of promptness. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't text you happy birthday until easily 11 a.m. at best.
Mike, thank you so much for your call. Our next call is from Quinn.
Hey, it's Quinn. First of all, congratulations on 100 episodes. I know you guys work really hard on this, and it takes a lot of work, and it's really cool you got to 100 episodes. And it's also one of the few enjoyable things, actually the only enjoyable thing about driving to work in the morning usually. Anyways, on a less serious note, since you mentioned Pujols last week, I feel like I need to comment on that. I wouldn't say they're not trying. They definitely didn't go all out, but they generally try to operate by like trying like worst case scenario be a few games above 500 unless something drastic happens. So yeah, that's probably about where I'd expect them to be. And also, yeah, they are going to be touring around Molina and Wayne and Molina and Pujols being there last year. But the thing is, like, them winning 85 games and sneaking into a wild card game and devil magicking their way by the Dodgers just seems like the most predictable thing that could possibly happen. And if you don't think that's going to happen, I don't know what to tell you. I don't think you've been paying attention. If you don't think that's going to happen, it's not actually going to happen, but I can dream.
Quinn, thanks so much for your kind words. We've appreciated all of your voicemails leading up to this episode and hopefully moving forward. And you know what? That's a great point. The National League Central Division, no teams in that division have really made any like huge moves, multiple moves to really catapult them into like clearly better. I mean, the Brewers have an unreal pitching staff, but their offense lets them down a lot. So why not the Cardinals? I mean, especially now that there's 12 teams in the playoffs, like the Cardinals can easily get in there because they're way better than basically every team in their division, with the exception of the Brewers.
You know what's funny, Quinn, is them signing Pujols loomed so large over everything. I literally forgot last week that it was Molina's last season too, that they're trotting the two of them around. And that just lends all the more credence to what you were saying. It's like, if there's ever going to be some devil magic, which I love that expression, by the way, if there's ever going to be some devil magic where the Cardinals sneak by again, it's going to be in the Pujols Molina farewell tour, because that's just how these things go. And yeah, I guess I'll see you in the playoffs, buddy. God damn it.
I was going to say, we've all bore witness to to 2006 Cardinals, who had like 83 wins.
Do we have to talk about the 2006 Cardinals on the 100th episode? Really?
On this, the 100th episode.
On this, the... On this, my 100th episode.
Quinn, thank you so much for your call. And thank you to all of our callers. You guys are amazing. Anyone else listening wants to get in on the fun, feeling brassy, give the Breaking Balls hotline a call. 631-820-7377. Now, John and I have been very excited for this last segment. Normally, we have a top three or a top six. But listen, you only have 100th episode in the history of your podcast, and this is it. So we had to really pull out all the stops. We've been working on this for weeks. Weeks. We wanted to keep with the theme of 100, so we had to incorporate that somehow, but we didn't want it to be too dry, like the best 100 home run hitters of all time. So for our top segment this week, we're doing the top 100, 100-plus win teams in MLB history. So, John, do you want to kick us off with number 100?
I would be honored, which also has two O's, which kind of look like zeros, which looks like a double bagel. So the 100th best 100 win team in MLB history is the 1899 Brooklyn Super Bos. Now, there's a few reasons for this. First of all, 1899. This was 2 years before the American League was invented, back when the National League was pure. They hadn't yet been sullied by the junior circuit. That's right. The Super Bos beat out teams like the Boston Beaneaters, the St. Louis Perfectos, the Chicago Orphans, the Louisville Colonels, the Cleveland Spiders. Real baseball teams, people. They went 101-47, finished 8 games on top of the Boston Beaneaters, led the way by their starting pitcher star Jay Hughes, who won 28 games. Not too shabby, I should say, especially in 1899. Now, this is before the AL, so they didn't even need a World Series. That's how pure this season was. They were the champions, and they didn't need to win any paltry playoff series or face any other teams to prove it. They finished on top. They were the best. Number 100 is the 1899 Brooklyn Super Bos.
The number 99 100-plus win team of all time is the 1942 St. Louis Cardinals. They went 106-48-2. This was apparently during a time where you could still end games in ties. I should have looked into how that happened because I am kind of interested. Like, I guess there was probably like no lights or something on the field, and that's why they just had to end things. I don't know. They won the World Series. This was the 5th World Series in the Cardinals franchise history. And the reason why I chose this as number 99, forget about the fact that they beat the Yankees. That's neither here nor there. I'm over it. This was Stan Musial's rookie year, the Denora Greyhound. He first burst onto the scene. I mean, he played like 12 games in 41, but this was the year that he really broke out. He was in the top 10 MVP votes. He was just right out of the gate, a fucking superstar. And the 42 Cardinals deserve a spot on this list because they won a World Series with Stan the Man leading the way.
No, no, mm-mm, mm-mm, no, no. No, 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 hell no, 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 I refuse, no, no.
We'll just have to speed things up.
Emily, that's an interesting, at best, choice for number 80, but we're going to push on with our list. So the number 79, and this is a bit of an obvious choice, I know, but the number 79 100 win team in Major League history is the 1970 Orioles. And let's be honest, the only reason they were that good is they were spurred on by their defeat by the Mets in the 1969 World Series. Because think about it, that 1969 Orioles team, they won 109 games, but they couldn't do it when it counted, you know? And that's a team with Brooks Robinson, Boog Powell, Jim Palmer, Frank Robinson. Come on, they even got notorious prankster relief pitcher Mo Drabowski back from Kansas City after he was lost in the expansion draft in 1969. It all lined up for them. They won 108 games that year and kicked the crap out of the Reds in the World Series after sweeping the Twins to get there. So I don't think it's very controversial to say that the 1970 Orioles are the 79th best 100 win team of all time.
Great Scott!
This is going to take forever.
John, that pick isn't bad. I mean, I had them a little further up on my list, but 57th is close enough. Now, the 56th pick of the top 100 win teams, the 1988 Oakland Athletics. This team went 104-58. 43-year-old Tony La Russa was at the helm. I can't believe he was 43 in 1988. I was very shocked by that. McGuire hit 32 home runs. Canseco hit 42 home runs. They didn't win the World Series. They came close, but this team really brought the Bay Area to its feet. They won the World Series the next year, but they came in just under 100 games. So that team, even though they won a World Series, doesn't hold a candle, in my opinion, to the 1988 Oakland A's.
Doggone it, I gotta get this thing recalibrated. Okay, let's try again.
All right, guys, thanks for sticking it out with us. I know the podcast has now entered its third hour, but I promise the payoff is coming. So the number 41 100 win MLB team of all time, the 2017 Indians. Now, let me get out ahead of a couple things here. I don't want to hear about the Astros. So yeah, sure, they won over 100 games that year, but it was a game less. They only won 101 to the Indians 1-2. And we all know the 2017 Astros cheated. Now, the Indians clearly did not cheat, as they had the decency to get eliminated in the ALDS by the Yankees like gentlemen. No trash cans, no cheating, none of that crap. Whatever happened after that, well, I can't really speak to it. But I'll just say that those Indians, they were 17 games up over the Twins. That was a team with future Mets Carrasco and Lindor on it. They had the 21-game win streak in August and September. I mean, hey, listen. I know it's been 5 years, and we can use that argument to say, enough with the Astros already. I have not had enough of the 2017 Indians. 102 wins, put a little bit of respect on their name. Jeez.
We're close. Super close.
All right, let's try this again.
We're really getting down to the nitty-gritty here. The number 27 top 100, 100-plus win team of all time is the 1998 Atlanta Braves. This team had it all. 106 wins. They had four future Hall of Famers in Chipper Jones, Tom Glavine, Greg Maddux, John Smoltz, and a borderline Hall of Famer, 21-year-old Andrew Jones. This is when Javi Lopez, the catcher, he was on fire. This team was unreal. They had it all except a World Series berth. Unfortunately for the Braves, the 114-win Yankees were the same year. The Braves lost to the Padres in the NLCS, but hey, that season is memorable. It's an all-time classic in Braves history, and that's why it is good for number 27 on this list.
Please, God, let this be it.
All right, folks, we finally did it. Thanks for sticking through with us here. We have come down to the top two. Now, I'm just going to say, I think it's honestly a little bit of a crime that this always works out that I don't get number one, because this should be number one, but here we are. A very, very obvious and strong number two. I don't think it's controversial to say the 1906 Cubs. Am I right? I mean, first of all, do I really need to say anything else? But I guess I will. Okay, so these Cubs won an MLB record 116 games. Now, I know what you're thinking. Oh, but John, the 2001 Mariners, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. The Cubs did it in 154 games, like men. The Mariners needed 162 to get there. Please. Now, granted, this is where the tragedy sets in. The Cubs lost the World Series in what's been called the biggest World Series upset of all time, against the quote-unquote hitless wonder 1906 Chicago White Sox. They hit 198 in that World Series, they committed 15 errors, and they still managed to top the mighty Cubs. These are Cubs, I should remind you, with Mordecai Brown leading the league with a 1.04 ERA. He almost threw a no-hitter that season. He lost it in the ninth, giving up a single. It's just, it's a crime that these Cubs lost the World Series, that the true kings of 100-win seasons are often relegated to a lower place because Seattle happened to do it in 2001 and then not even make the World Series, let alone have the decency to lose it like the Cubs. If I don't stop now, I could go on for another 4 hours about this. So I'm going to stop and just say the 1906 Cubs should really be number one, but we're settling on number two on the list of top 100 win MLB teams.
Like John had just stated.
I know the problem you're having. You picked the 1906 Cubs for number one.
This is awkward.
It's a logical choice. I get it. I get it.
The 1906 Cubs, if we had said they were number one, I don't think we'd have any arguments, but I'd be remiss if I didn't choose the next team as the number one top 100, 100-win team. You guys know what I'm going to say. Everyone knows what I'm going to say. The 2021 San Francisco Giants.
San Francisco Giants.
The Giants.
Yeah, I saw it coming.
Listen, they won 107 games. Cinderella story out of nowhere. The first 100-win season in Giants franchise history since 2003. But it was the most wins in franchise history. And this is a franchise, folks, dating all the way back to the 1890s. This is one of the original teams. And this team, the 2021 Giants, led by 35-year-old Brandon Crawford, who looks like Roman Reigns, 34-year-old Buster Posey. This was like the oldest team of all time as well. And listen, did they win a World Series? No. Did they win the National League Championship? Again, no. Did they win the Divisional Series? Listen, the answer is no. But did they win our hearts? And the hearts of everyone in the San Francisco Bay Area? Yes. And that is exactly why, after hours of listing the top 100 win teams, they were the clear choice to come out on top. Their cream home uniforms rose to the top.
I gotta tell you, Emily, that felt like it took all of 5 minutes. It really did.
I mean, when you're ranking the top 100 win teams, time is just a social construct at that point.
Insane. You could have listened to about, I would say, 5 or 6 Breaking Balls episodes in that time.
And that about wraps it up for episode 100 of Breaking Balls. We want to thank all of our listeners sticking by us through that whole list. You guys are amazing. We appreciate you listening to us every single week and moving forward. We also want to thank our callers. You guys are awesome. Anyone else listening wants to get in on the fun? Feeling brassy? Give the Breaking Balls hotline a call, 631-820-7377. You can also find us on Twitter, at BreakBallsPod. And we want to thank our amazing and patient and talented producer and engineer, DJ Bingington. You can find him on Twitter as well, at DJ B-I-N-G-I-N-G-T-O-N. And we will catch you guys next week.